Oyez, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 061084, Bison Building Materials Limited versus Lloyd K. Aldridge from Harris County and the First Court of Appeals District. Docket number 070040, In Re Global Santa Fe Corporation, which is an original proceeding. And docket number 070135, East Texas Saltwater Disposal Company, Incorporated versus Richard Leon Orlein from Gregg County and the Sixth Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument and expects to complete all of them before noon. We will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in 061084, Bison Building Materials versus Lloyd Aldridge.
May it please the court, Mr. Van Arsdell will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. We are here today to address two errors. The first error was committed by the Court of Appeals when it dismissed this appeal for want of jurisdiction. We understand that jurisdiction is the issue of the day, not only in this case, but in the Werlein case to be argued later on this morning. But there is a second error at issue in this case, and that was the error committed by the trial court when it refused to enforce a valid post-injury waiver. Now, this issue is of paramount importance to workplace injury litigants in this state. If the trial court's order is allowed to stand, it could serve as a precedent which could lead to the review and undoing of validly executed post-injury settlements in this state. And for that reason, we ask this court to accept jurisdiction, reverse the trial court's order, and render judgment in Bison's favor. Starting the jurisdiction issue in this case, the Court of Appeals erred because it had jurisdiction over the trial court's order pursuant to the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. 171.098A provides for appellate jurisdiction over a number of trial court orders concerning arbitration.
The Court of Appeals said that this is governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, and the parties seem to agree with that. Is that true?
That's true, Your Honor.
Why do we look to the state law for that doesn't seem to apply to federal arbitration agreements?
Even though substantively the law that governs this arbitration agreement and the award that was reached in this case is governed by the FAA, if the review is initiated in a Texas court, the Texas procedure governs, and that is why we're talking about the Texas Arbitration Act, Section 171.098.
Well, I think that assuming Texas procedure governs, still 171.002 of the chapter says this chapter doesn't apply to it. It has a list of things that. One of them's claim for personal injury that I guess would make it not applicable to the agreement in this case.
That's true, and that is why the parties stipulated that the FAA would be the governing law.
But you still think we look to 170, a part of that chapter for appealability?
That's right. It's the procedural law that Texas courts have to follow. In fact, if we followed federal law, it's clear that federal law allows for the appeal of an order directing a rehearing. It's not clear that the Texas Arbitration Act does the same, and that's why we're talking about the Texas Arbitration Act today.
But the question is, did the legislature intend Chapter 171 to apply to state the procedural requirements when a contract is governed by the FAA?
Yes, I believe it did, Your Honor.
Why? What part of it says it does?
Well, I believe it's the case that no matter what law the parties determine governs their dispute, it's the procedural law of the state.
But we've got a lot of other procedures. 171 is for contracts governed by the Texas Arbitration Act. This one's not governed by the Texas. We have a lot of other procedures that we can apply, Texas procedures, Texas What is there about 171 that says this is intended to apply to FAA appeals as well? Is there anything in it that says so?
Well, certainly there's nothing explicit in it. I would direct this court's attention to the holding of Tanox versus Aiken Gump, which held that parties may determine the scope of review that a trial court can use in reviewing an arbitration award, and that's exactly what the parties did here, is grant an expanded scope of review. Notwithstanding the parties' agreement to expand the scope of review, that holding still used the Texas Arbitration Act to determine whether there was appealability of an order.
And you say that's not a jurisdictional question, that's just scope of review.
The Tanox decision was, yes.
Well, that's what you're arguing for here. You're saying it's not jurisdictional. We just agreed that they'll look at everything rather than deferential standard.
Correct.
Could you do that on a appeal of an administrative agency? Administrative agencies make fact findings. We're supposed to review them, substantial evidence review. Isn't that a jurisdictional standard?
I'm not sure I follow, Your Honor.
Substantial evidence of review or administrative agencies, that's all we have jurisdiction to review.
Correct.
And if an agency and a party fighting with the agency over a rule wanted us not to apply substantial evidence review, they both agreed to it. We couldn't do that, could we?
I don't believe so. I believe the rule in Tanox was following the presumption of the support of arbitration. We enforce the agreement to arbitrate in the first place. And Tanox says not only do we enforce the agreement to arbitrate, we will enforce the standard of review that the parties agree to in that arbitration agreement.
Is that right? Why is that right? If you can't agree to it in the administrative context, because it's a jurisdictional limit on the courts, we can't look at anything more than substantial evidence when it comes to us for an administrative agency. Why can we do it when the parties disagree to it in arbitration?
Well, I think the administrative proceeding presumes a regulatory scheme where the legislature has occupied the entire field. The whole presumption of arbitration is the parties reach an agreement to arbitrate in the first place, and that's just a continuation of that policy to support whatever agreements they make within limits about what the powers
within
are.
Within what limits? Can the parties agree that a decision of this court applying a particular standard of review just won't be applicable?
I don't believe that they could narrow the scope of review. Certainly the legislature has spoken as to the type of review that every decision should be able to be reviewed under, and that be the Texas Arbitration Act, reviewing it for corruption or fraud or decisions outside of the scope of agreement. I don't think an agreement could further limit that. I don't think there could be an agreement that says we will not allow any judicial review of the arbitration award no matter what. I think that'd be against public policy.
But the point is, we haven't decided that issue. That's an issue bubbling around in the federal courts and in the Texas courts, and we have not addressed that issue. That's a jurisdictional issue, isn't it? I mean, if the trial court acted within its power and authority to decide whether to confirm the arbitration award, then wouldn't the Court of Appeals always have jurisdiction to decide whether the trial court properly exercised its jurisdiction?
I believe so.
Don't we have to address that as a threshold issue, the party's ability to agree on a different standard of review?
I would say that would have to be a requirement. Yes, Your Honor.
Just on the question of whether an order is the order is interlocutory or final, just kind of walk me through this. If a trial court says, I think that the basis of the arbitrator's decision is contrary to the law or to the facts, let's say to the facts, the overwhelming facts, is that a ground to for a trial court to remand or have an arbitrator rehear?
Certainly not under the traditional review of the Texas Arbitration Act.
What are the circumstances under which a trial court has authority to send the case back to the arbitrator?
When that trial court has been empowered by agreement to have a broader scope of review, such as the trial court had in this case, it can perform a review that a court of appeals would normally perform on trial court decisions, on trial court bench decisions. And so any review and remand that a court of appeals could make in a similar circumstance, that's what the parties in this case have empowered this trial court to do.
And I guess that's where I keep coming back to my question, because I think I heard you agree that the party's ability to pick a different standard of review is a jurisdictional issue. That's a threshold issue. And if that's the case, then the Court of Appeals would have jurisdiction to decide that. And once it exercised jurisdiction over that, then it could decide the other issues that were before it.
I believe that's absolutely correct. That's another reason why they erred, separate and apart from the shortcomings of the trial court's order. By virtue of the fact that we had an agreement that expanded the scope of review, that gave the Court of Appeals jurisdiction to review that and make a determination.
Mr. Van Arsdale, let me ask you a question. I don't want to go off the reservation with this, but in getting ready for this argument, it appears to me that there might be two arbitration agreements that are involved here or could be involved, and it's not briefed. It's not in the lower court's opinion, but it seems to me that under the current, the arbitration agreement we're talking about, which gives the trial court some, the party's right to appeal to the trial court under certain conditions, is except if there is arbitration under the benefit plan portion of this setup. And, of course, there was a benefit paid under the benefit plan, which appears to have an arbitration agreement, but it's not in the record and we don't know what it says. Now, if that's so, why are we looking at the first arbitration agreement and not the second one? Why doesn't that one apply?
Your Honor, the claim was for damages, money damages, not benefit damages, money damages as a result of a workplace injury. The arbitration agreement you've referenced allows a worker, if he's gone to a medical provider and he believes he's entitled to a certain benefit, say a surgery or some procedure or some prescription, and it's been denied to him by that medical provider and Bison as the administrator of the plan, he has a right to arbitrate that decision. This is not that case.
Okay, so but the provision in the first arbitration agreement that says it applies except or unless the other one applies, how do we know in the record that it doesn't apply except for the parties not just saying that it doesn't?
Well, we have from the record his claim in arbitration, and all it mentions is money damages under the plan.
Okay, so you say we don't have to worry about that one.
That's my assessment.
Okay, thank you.
Now, once we've passed the jurisdictional threshold issue, it's clear that under the TAA, this order was appealable.
Mr. Van Arsdale, let me follow up on that. I'm not sure I'm clear. There's a mutual arbitration agreement attached to the filings, mutual agreement to arbitrate claims. Then there's also attached a summary plan description of Bison's Building Material LTD's workplace injury plan. And that defines this document, as I read its title, as a summary of the plan. Is the actual plan, the workplace injury plan, in the record?
It is not in the record.
Okay. And Justice Green was pointing out that the mutual agreement to arbitrate says that it covers work-related illnesses or injuries, claims for benefits under an employee benefit plan or pension plan, except for claims under employment benefit or pension plan, and then has the two bases for the exception. If the actual plan, the workplace injury plan, is not in the record, how can we make sure that this exception doesn't apply?
I think by virtue of the fact that Mr. Aldridge's claim in arbitration is in the record, and you can see based on what he's pled that it does not fit that exception, even though the full plan is not in there, the summary terms would tell you enough to show that it's not part of that arbitration.
The exceptions is if the claims procedure culminates in an arbitration procedure different from this one. The arbitration plan and the workplace injury plan may be different from this one, but how do we know if that workplace injury plan is not in the record?
I think the language there explains the categories of the different types of arbitration that are not covered by the plan. And I think if you look at Mr. Aldridge's complaint in arbitration, it clearly sets forth a claim for personal injury damages, which are covered by the agreement. I don't think you need to see the full scope of the other arbitration agreement to make that determination.
Okay.
I think there's enough in the record that we can already pass that threshold.
If as you sleep on that, you think differently, you might consider some supplemental briefing. I'm going to look at it more closely myself.
Very well, Your Honor.
Somebody comes in, they've got an arbitration award, and the other side says, well, Judge, I want you to vacate it. And the other, the winner says, well, Judge, there's no grounds for that. He says, well, I just think it was wrong. I just think the award was wrong. So I'm going to vacate it and send it back to another arbitration, tell them to try it again. And we're going to keep doing this until we get an arbitration award that I think is comes out the way I think it should. There's no appeal from that till it's all over. Is that your view?
Well, that's a question to be answered today specifically.
I'm just asking if that's your view.
It's my view that if there's a ruling on the motion to confirm under A3 of that provision, I believe an argument can be made that jurisdiction exists. And certainly that's what the Texarkana Court of Appeals ruled in Werlein, and what's being decided here today later on this morning.
But, I mean, if he says, well, I'm just going to hold that motion to confirm and deny, what I'm going to do is vacate and send it back. Is there an appeal from that?
Under that circumstance, I don't believe there would be an appeal.
And it looks to me like that would just undo the whole system. I mean, the trial judge could just keep sending it back to the arbitration panel till he got something he liked.
It would certainly open it up to abuse, certainly. And in that circumstance where the ruling on the motion to confirm is held in abeyance until he gets a result that he likes, perhaps a mandamus proceeding could be initiated to force a ruling on the motion to confirm. But that certainly is an extra burden on the parties that I don't think the legislature intended. But that certainly is a question that's more squarely put with Werlein than our case, because in our order there was no rehearing directive.
But that's no different than a motion for new trial. I mean, technically a court continued to grant a motion for new trial, and we've held that there's no review of that motion.
Justice O'Neill, I see my time is up. May I briefly answer? Respectfully, I disagree. New trials are issued by the same tribunal that's seen the error live and in person. In the error we're talking about today, this is a de facto court of appeals review that would be ordering a new trial as if it were a court of appeals. And those are always appealable.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Arbuckle will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Obviously, it seems to me that the key issue here is whether or not 171.098A makes this order that was entered by the court interlocutory, or whether it makes it appealable.
What about the threshold jurisdictional issue we were discussing? If the trial court did not have the power to do what it did, isn't that a threshold jurisdictional issue that the Court of Appeals always has jurisdiction to decide?
Okay, I assume that question that I'm being asked about is the question of whether or not the court can consider the trial court can consider the arbitration award on the basis of as if it were a trial court sitting
there. Plenary review. Plenary review.
Yeah. And I do not believe that that's a jurisdictional question. And the reason right now that's pending before the United States Supreme Court on the FAA in the Hall Street case, Hall Street versus Mattel. It was argued in November. It has not been handed down yet. But that case was tried under the FAA. There's something very unique about this particular agreement, which is in the appendix to the petitioner's brief under Part 5. The second paragraph says that the FAA applies, but it does not, but only to the extent that it's not contradicted by this agreement. If this agreement doesn't contradict it, then you fall back to state law. Now, state courts are general courts of jurisdiction. The presumption is that they have jurisdiction, not that they don't have jurisdiction. In fact, section of the Texas Practice and Remedies Code 154.027 allows arbitrations to be non-binding or binding. So clearly a case that falls between those two, where the parties said, well, we'll arbitrate first, but we'll allow a party to have the court review that on the basis of whether or not there's an error like there would be in a trial court. That's not a jurisdictional question. The trial court clearly has jurisdiction to answer that, to deal with that. What we're really talking about is whether or not the court is going to enforce the party's agreement, which I think also distinguishes it from an administrative proceeding where the procedures are set by statute and by court decision.
I guess my question is, I mean, I hear you saying that the parties should be able to do that under Texas law, agree right. to a standard of review. But if they can't, if we were to say that the parties could not agree to a different standard, in that event the trial court would not have jurisdiction to do what it did. Isn't that right?
Well, sure. If this court says the trial court doesn't have jurisdiction, obviously the court would not have jurisdiction.
But, I mean, that's the question. And why wouldn't the Court of Appeals have jurisdiction to review that jurisdictional issue?
Well, in this case, that issue, the issue of whether or not the trial court had jurisdiction was never raised by any party in the case. The parties both agreed that under Texas law, at least implicitly, because it was never raised, that the trial court had jurisdiction. And when no objection to jurisdiction is raised in a general court in the state level, a court of general jurisdiction, that can be waived. Because it's a general court, not like a federal court, which is a special court of jurisdiction. The fact is this issue hasn't been briefed by either party in this case, because it hasn't been raised by either party in this case. It also is important.
Looking at the trial court's order, the trial judge didn't think the arbitration wasn't finished. I mean, I read the part of her order that says, because there's remaining fact questions. But isn't that just because she thought the fact questions were decided wrong? It's not like the arbitration wasn't over. It was over.
I think...
Disagreed with the outcome, right?
No, I don't think so. Well, I think that what the court... I wouldn't presume to say the court agreed or disagreed with the outcome. What the court found is that as a legal matter question, Reyes and the conspicuousness of the waiver language applied to a post-injury waiver.
But did the arbitrator said they didn't apply to it?
He actually... My recollection is that even though that issue was addressed by the parties, he just simply dismissed it. He didn't write to that issue.
Well, how can...
But he couldn't...
I don't understand the trial court's order, because there are fact questions on.
But
that's like saying you have a jury verdict that comes up and a judgment based on a jury verdict, and the Court of Appeals reverses saying, well, there was a fact question here. Yeah, there was, and that's why we had a jury verdict on it.
There was no...
The trial judge can't reverse this for having a fact question for some fact the arbitrator decided, can she?
Well, the arbitrator never had a hearing. The arbitrator decided on what would be equivalent to a summary judgment, although it didn't mean...
The arbitrator has to have a hearing?
No, but what I'm saying is...
And what ground can the trial judge do what she did?
If it were like a summary judgment... The court can say, no, wait, if you look at what both sides presented in that summary judgment, there's a fact issue here,
But an arbitrator can decide things on summary disposition even if there are fact questions. That's part of the wonderful world of arbitration. They can do it any way they want.
Well, as I understand the Federal Arbitration Act, there are specific requirements in the Federal Arbitration Act that the parties are entitled to a hearing. So unless there is a
legal... Entitled to an oral hearing.
Well, that they're entitled to a hearing.
Well, that doesn't have to mean an oral hearing.
But there was no hearing provided in this case at all.
You filed briefs. Mm-hmm. You filed arguments with the arbitrator. The arbitrator dismissed it. Now, in trial court, that's a hearing. Why is that not a hearing in arbitration?
Because the FAA says the parties are entitled to present evidence. If the parties are required in an arbitration... To do essentially the equivalent of summary judgment, that was if you go way back, why courts didn't like to enforce arbitration agreements, because arbitrators could do that. So they set up, in the FAA, they set up some specific things and says if you've got to let the parties present their evidence. The whole point is that you're not going to do all this discovery. You're not going to be able to go take depositions anytime you want to. So you can't decide things summarily like that, because the parties don't have the opportunity that they have in court to do the things they need to do to get to the point where you can determine it summarily.
Must the evidence be live?
I'm sorry?
Must the evidence be live?
No, it can be a written submission of evidence, but if there are, for example, things like people need to be subpoenaed. For example, in this case, we had no opportunity to cross-examine the person that filed an affidavit on their behalf.
Well, let me...
Unlike we would in court.
We're talking about a hearing, but the argument's been made that the issues that the trial court specified were remaining are really legal questions. And if they are really legal questions, then there really is no need for factual development before the arbitrator. And why wouldn't whether the waiver satisfied the fair notice requirement be a legal question?
Well, that question is, and the court found it in the trial court found it in our favor and against the arbitration. That therefore allowed the court to get to, or would cause the arbitrator to get to fact issues that the arbitrator had not gotten to. The arbitrator just said he signed the waiver, we're through. The arbitrator never discussed the ambiguity arguments and the conspicuousness of the waiver itself.
The order does say that there's a fact question on actual knowledge, which could be, depending on the evidence, if it's competing, a question of fact. Did the trial court indicate what it thought should happen after entry of this order?
No, the only
Can
thing
it
I
can say that the arbitrator needs to decide this. I mean, if this is a summary judgment type example that perhaps should apply, then if an order says there are fact questions, then I mean there's presumably more proceedings to occur. I'm not sure that exactly applies here, that analogy. But is any indication that the trial court said what she thought should happen next?
There's been no contact with anything that the trial court said it since the order, other than when
I'm not asking if you called the trial court
in preparation
for this argument.
No, I
at
understand.
The time of the entry of the order and the proceedings related to it, did the trial court say anything about what she thought should happen next?
No, the order came. The court heard arguments of counsel, took it under advisement, issued the order. We weren't present when the order was
issued. And to follow up on that point, if we were to affirm the Court of Appeals, where would that leave us?
It would leave us in the trial court, either to voluntarily go back to the arbitration or to apply to the court for an order to return us to arbitration.
I mean, if this waiver's no good, you've got to decide whether the guy was injured or not. Right?
Right.
And the only person that can do that is the arbitrator.
Right.
So you have to go back. There's no way to read this order other than an implied you have to go back to the arbitrator.
Absolutely. This order remands this case.
So the trial judge, even though she didn't direct rehearing, the fact is she did.
That's right. I agree with that completely. And certainly when the parties appealed the case, both parties thought that too. It's even in Bison's brief. They refer to the court entering an order and remanding the case to the arbitrator.
But why did the Court of Appeals think they didn't have jurisdiction?
Because of a line of cases out of this court that it was fairly recent, I think, at that time, in which the court questioned whether or not certain arbitration, because of the conflict between the FAA and the TAA, the FAA allows certain interlocutory appeals, but the court had ruled that if you're talking about those kinds of issues, you apply state law because it's procedural.
When I'm saying without directing a rehearing vacating, I've seen cases where the arbitrator, the parties had five issues and the arbitrators decided three. And it seems to me that's one situation where, in effect, the arbitrators thought they were done, but they're clearly wrong because there was two things they haven't decided yet. But that wasn't this case. The arbitrators, if the arbitrator was right, that the guy waived all his rights in this post-injury thing he signed, then the arbitration is over. There was nothing left hanging by the arbitrator, assuming the arbitrator was right.
If that's right, if you make the presumption that the arbitrator was correct in how he applied the law, then the arbitration award was final.
So the arbitration itself was not interlocutory.
Right.
So that,
I agree with
that. The thing that confuses me, if the trial judge is in effect to the Court of Appeals in this case, normally you have the trial court, Court of Appeals, and then us. In this case, you got a different trier of fact. That's the arbitrator. The trial court sits as the Court of Appeals. If a Court of Appeals, just in a regular case, reversed and remanded for a new trial, nobody would argue that case is interlocutory. They've still got a trial to try. I mean, we would review the Court of Appeals case because the trial was finished and they've reversed it for a new trial, but we look at those all the time. Why did the Court of Appeals think why did the statute say if it's reversing and remanding that that's not appealable? Seems like it should be.
Both of the parties in this case made that presumption when we filed our appeals. Bison filed an appeal of the trial court's order.
This
and
was
we
a surprise
filed our,
to you, too.
And we filed it, too. And the Court of Appeals said, wait a minute, sure, you agreed to let the trial court do this, but we're still – our jurisdiction doesn't arise out of the agreement. Our restriction arises out of the code. And the code says that we can only review the order if it's final, and this isn't final, therefore we can't review it. That's what the, and I think that after going back and being alerted to that issue by the Court of Appeals, that the Court of Appeals was correct. In the state court level, you start with the general rule, which is the general rule is that the Court of Appeals can only review a case that is final, either because it says it's final in unequivocal language or because it clearly is because it disposes of all the issues. Obviously, this trial court order does not say it's final, and it obviously says that there are still issues. It says that here's the fact issues that still need to be resolved. So it's not appealable in that sense unless it becomes appealable under the TAA.
Why does the TAA apply?
I do not necessarily think the TAA does apply. It only applies if this court decides that just simply because this is an arbitration, you have to apply an arbitration act. As I mentioned, under 154.027 of the same code, which is a whole different chapter, it simply says the parties can have an arbitration and it can be binding or non-binding. Under those circumstances, you would just apply, it seems to me, common law. In fact, in the arguments before the Supreme Court of the United States in the Hall Street case that I mentioned earlier, that's talking about whether the FAA allows the parties to agree to a court review on different grounds, one of the things that the justices concentrated on in their questioning in that case was, why do you care about the FAA? This is a diversity case. Just go back and use common law. And so that's why I say under common law principles, that's where you start. And where you start under common law principles, this is not an this is an interlocutory order.
In the federal system, would this be an appealable order?
I believe, if I remember the provisions of the FAA, the FAA does provide for this order to be appealable, but
it says
I'm not absolutely sure.
It says you can appeal an order vacating an award.
Right. I think of a case that's interpreted that, and I can't think of one. I'm just going on the statutory language.
It doesn't have the rehearing language
right.
That the state statute.
And the federal court might have had some concern about that Your Honor raised about whether or not a court could just gin it around until the court got it the way they wanted it. However, I think that there are remedies for that. They may not be a direct appeal, but something like a mandamus or a writ of something or other. I would have to look them up. But
writ of something or other.
I'd have to look them up because my Latin was never very good. But there's writs of I forget what they're called, but I think that there are remedies if a trial court does abuse its discretion in that fashion.
Getting to the merits, does Reyes govern this claim?
Yes.
on fair notice and conspicuousness and the post-injury? Just getting to the merits, why would you prevail?
Okay. As the court knows, the Reyes case says that in a pre-injury waiver, a waiver that's signed before injury, is at a time that it's not governed by the labor code, which now has changed it for pre-injury waivers, that it has to be conspicuous and there has to be or there has to be absolute or evidence that the person actually understood it. We say that based on the language of the Reyes case, which does not make a distinction between a pre-injury and a post-injury waiver, that same standard applies to a post-injury waiver. All of the principled reasons that the court gave in that case, which have to do with special workers' compensation kinds of issues, apply equally in a post-injury and a pre-injury. This is not like a settlement. A settlement is something that's drawn up after something happens. This may be called a post-injury waiver, but it's a form created before there ever was an injury. So it's essentially a pre-injury waiver that's being signed post-injury. And
isn't that like a settlement? I mean, you've been injured, and you sit down and you sign an agreement agreeing to take plans, take under the benefit plan in lieu of your common law remedy. Why isn't that like a settlement?
Well, it's not like a settlement in the same sense that a pre-injury waiver is not like a settlement, because it's not negotiated at the time of the injury. It's not based on the injury. It's simply based on a form that was created long before the injury occurred that the person is being asked to sign at a time when they're unable to work and they need to go to a doctor, and someone's saying, sure, sign here and you can go to a doctor.
Well, they're settlement forms that lawyers use, and they plug in the names. Basically, the release language is the same. The names change. I mean, why does it matter that the form preexisted the injury?
Well, because the form puts you into a system. It doesn't settle the case. It puts you into a system where the employer, through the plan, and under ERISA law, the summary plan description is binding on the employer. It puts them into a system that the employer controls the whole game. They control whether or not you can get benefits. They control whether or not you can go to a doctor, what doctor you can go to, whether or not the doctor is actually going to get paid. And what benefits you get, if any. Those are all become controlled by the... It's essentially a cost control measure by the employer. It's not a settlement. A settlement is when you get something and you know exactly what you're getting at the time you sign, and you give up something and you know exactly what you're giving up. In a injury waiver like this that throws you into a system, it essentially, all it does is throw you into a system that your employer the next day could say, I'm not going to give you any benefits under the plan. Therefore, then you're limited to suing supposedly under the plan. You can't sue for your actual damages, even though the employer's messed you around by getting you to sign this. So essentially the employer can say, you sign this, it limits my liability to you ever to the plan, but you get nothing for that because I have discretion.
In this case, you got $80,000 worth of medical benefits and indemnity payments, as we understand the record.
That's right, and they were cut off after a year.
Okay, but he did get something for it. Now, also the trial court said that he sent it back because the waiver satisfy the fair notice requirements? And is that a matter of law? I think we had that maybe touched on a little earlier.
Well, in this particular situation, the way I took that, there's two pages to this waiver, and the page that he signed is only a medical waiver. And then there's another page that you can put on top of it that's the injury waiver.
So the question is it a matter of law, or is it a question of fact?
I think it's a matter. What I said in my brief is it's a mixed question. There are fact issues that have to be determined to apply the law.
Any further questions? Thank you,
Counsel. Go ahead and talk about your second issue about the post-injury waiver at this point.
Certainly, Your Honor. The question is what this court meant when it decided Reyes. Do the fair notice requirements apply to post-injury waiver? And the first sentence of Reyes explains the issue. Is do the fair notice requirements need to be met when an employee is enrolled in a workplace injury plan? In this case, the record is clear. He enrolled in that plan almost a year before the injury. He was eligible for benefits the moment, basically when he started his employment and signed that form as part of his initiation and in training. It wasn't until a year later, after he suffered an injury, that he was then subsequently asked to sign a post-injury waiver explaining that he did now want to receive those benefits in exchange for waiving his claim for damages as a result of his injury.
But he could have received them without signing it.
Well, what he would have received is emergency medical care. That's what the plan provides. He would not have received continuing care and wage replacements under the plan unless he signed the post-injury waiver.
Of course, he could get emergency from the emergency room by showing up.
He could do that, but Bison would pay for that under this plan.
Do you agree that the jurisdictional point, the trial court's power to go beyond beyond the review that's provided, was waived? Was that briefed in the Court of Appeals? It's not briefed here.
It was not briefed to the Court of Appeals.
So do you agree that that issue was waived?
Well, to the extent subject matter jurisdiction, assuming that is a subject matter jurisdiction, can be waived, then possibly it is. Just to return briefly to Reyes, the very nature of what the fair notice requirements are tell us that it's only in a pre-injury context where they apply. One of the requirements of fair notice is the express negligence doctrine. And as this court held in Green versus Solis, part of the express negligence doctrine is to determine whether a party has excused itself from future negligence. The very definition of what it is assumes it's a pre-injury context. And as the law stands today, indemnity agreements are virtually the only context where the fair notice requirements apply, because pre-injury waivers in the workplace context have been outlawed by the labor code. So even the very definition of what the fair notice requirements presume that is a pre-injury context. And for that reason alone, the trial court's determination should be reversed. Just to return briefly to Justice Johnson and Justice O'Neill, your question about whether this order that the trial court issued truly contemplates a rehearing, and it's clear that it doesn't.
Clear that it what?
It clearly does not.
What were you going to do? See, the judge says, well, there's two issues, period. Nobody does anything. Nobody says, okay, well, should we have a hearing or get a remand, or what should we do?
If this court were to confirm and affirm the Court of Appeals, we would be essentially left in legal limbo. We would need some more direction from the trial court about what happens.
You know, you'd go straight back to the arbitrator, I think.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree, because the arbitrator should not have to de novo figure out the law himself when it has, in fact, a reviewing court to tell him what the law is. Remember, the trial court's been empowered with a quasi-Court of Appeals power to review. A court of appeals would never remand a case back to a trial court to say, you need to figure out what the law is on this question of law, which is essentially what perhaps the trial court intended to do here. That would never happen. They would tell the trial court what the law is, and if there was a subsequent fact issue that needed to be determined, then and only then would a remand happen.
Well, but if it's an interlocutory order, if we were to affirm the CA and say that it was interlocutory, then the trial court knows it's interlocutory, and the trial court needs to do something else to move it to finality. I mean, it doesn't seem like legal limbo would last for very long.
That's right. We would need some further direction from the court, and hopefully at that time, in that event, the trial court would clarify the issues, perhaps give us a true ruling on the fair notice issue to see whether it's been met or not, as only the trial court can determine at that point. And then and only then, perhaps we would need to go back at her direction.
Do y'all dispute that the trial court here was sort of acting as an appellate court and had to therefore apply or comply with trap rules?
That's exactly our contention.
So under Rule 43.2, about the types of judgments that appellate courts may enter, what specific subpart does this fall in? Where does it fit? Which one?
It fits as well. Actually, it is out of conformity with that rule. A court of appeals normally would not confirm in part and reverse in part. It reversed the whole thing for further determination, and that's not what this court did.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.